This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 67 was recorded on June 15th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Quite a few listeners have asked us where else besides Macro Voices they can find professional grade investment commentary on the internet. So I'm delighted to have the opportunity to interview HedgEye founder and CEO Keith McCullough as this week's featured interview guest. If you think of Macro Voices and Real Vision Television as what professionals and serious private investors listen to in the evening or at the gym or in the car, think of HedgEye as what they tune into at 9 a.m. when they need a briefing on what happened overnight in Asian trading and what's on deck for U.S. markets in the coming day. Keith and I will take a tour around the globe discussing everything from Jeff Gundlach's view that a secular low yield is in on the 10-year treasury to Kyle Bass's view that China's credit unwind will send a wave of deflation around the globe. We'll discuss last Friday's tech flash crash and why Keith is still bullish U.S. growth stocks, despite also holding a strong view that the reflation trade is rolling over, and a whole lot more.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. We taped this show a couple hours early again this week, so our commentary won't include anything that's happened in the markets after 2 p.m. on Thursday. And before we dive into the markets, any comments on the FOMC's 25 basis point rate hike there, Eric?
You know, I don't have a whole lot to say. I guess if you look at the market reaction, it seems like a lot of people thought there would be more dovish of a dovish hike. And of course, a hike unto itself is a hawkish move. When people talk about a dovish hike, what they were expecting was a hike, but then a lot of discussion in the press conference afterwards, kind of downplaying the hawkishness and indicating more of a dovish leaning. And I guess it wasn't quite as dovish as some people expected if we look at the reaction in markets. In general, though, you know, the big picture is everybody thought there was going to be a 25 basis point hike, and there was. So it was pretty much cooked into the market already.
All right, well, let's move on to that S&P 500, which certainly started off on the initial reactions to the Fed a little bit higher. But once the press conference went on, the stock market started to decline, hitting down a low around the 2416 area before reversing. Right now, as we speak, we're trading around the 2428 level. What's your thinking on the S&P here?
Well, you know, I still, of course, think that this market is way overvalued on a fundamental basis. But the people that are saying the top is in and the crash is coming next week, I don't see the proximal trigger. I don't see what the catalyst is to bring that on. I'm also particularly glad to have Keith on the show today. He has an opposing view. He is very bullish U.S. growth equities in particular. So I think that will definitely contrast the bearish view that we've had from several guests in the program. You could look, you know, what I've said in the past is I don't see any reason to think it's coming now. I'll say maybe the exception to that, this 3% hiccup in tech stocks. First of all, it wasn't a crash like people were calling it. It was a 3% hiccup. But still, the way that that happened, where there was no apparent news trigger and all of the sudden liquidity just evaporated and those big names, particularly the FANG stocks, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, sold off very, very sharply in a matter of minutes, it kind of reminds me of how much vulnerability there is in these markets. You know, the traditional suppliers of liquidity, the market makers, were pretty much run out of business by high frequency trading. We don't know what a crash is going to look like in this new HFT dominated world. Back in the 2008 event, we still had those traditional market makers in the marketplace. So when I see something happen that quickly, it makes me think, boy, that could have been the beginning of something really big. It wasn't in this case. So I'm not playing the long side of equities. I think the market is overvalued on a fundamental basis. On the other hand, just from a momentum perspective, there's plenty of reason to think that this crazy upside move could continue. So if I were going to play the market at all, it would be with calls, not with outright long.
All right. Well, let's move on to that dollar index, because the moment the press conference started, suddenly all of these, there was a pop in the euro initially, there was a strength in the Canadian dollar, and suddenly the moment Janet Yellen's press conference started, we suddenly saw the U.S. dollar just blast off and all of these currencies begin these big, deep corrections. What's your thinking here on the dollar index?
Well, you know, we're seeing a bounce after the Fed's hike. Again, the hike apparently was not perceived as quite as dovish of a hike as some people were expecting. It was a hawkish hike, which kind of makes sense because it's a hike. But this bounce we're seeing, will it last? Is this going to be a reversal in direction? I definitely continue to hold a bullish long-term view on the U.S. dollar. But as our regular listeners know, I've been sitting this dance out for the last several weeks because I don't really see, if I look at the chart, you know, it's the chart's looking ugly and I haven't seen a reversal of that chart pattern. Is this move that we're seeing in reaction to the Fed going to last? It'll be very interesting to see, but it certainly hasn't moved up enough yet to persuade me that the rout in the dollar index is over. So we'll see what comes next.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil. Obviously, the inventory numbers came out, and once again, oil took a plunge, this time down to the 44 handle. Does it go any lower here?
I think it may. You know, the death cross that we talked about last week, which is where the 50-day moving average crosses down below the 200-day moving average. When we talked about it last week, it was just barely below the line, and it was a little bit debatable. Well, we have a very clear death cross signal now. At the same time, we also have the CRB index looking very weak, very bearish chart pattern there. So commodities in general rolling over, death cross confirmed. These are all very bearish signals that portend a further sell-off in oil prices. This week's inventory was a drawdown on crude oil inventories, but it was a smaller drawdown than expected by analysts. It was only 1.7 million barrels, 1.2 million of that from Cushing, Oklahoma. The thing, though, is gasoline, once again, 2.1 million barrel build in the heat of summer driving season. Gasoline inventories building against expectations by 2.1 million barrels. Distillates also building by 328,000 barrels. So those finished product builds coupled with a smaller than expected drawdown in crude oil really sent prices moving to the downside. It really makes me kind of wonder what I said last week is, okay, we had that really big build on inventory, but you know, it felt like it was too good to be true, even given my bearish views. It seemed like maybe that number was bogus. Well, it looks like this week's number wasn't a build this time. It was a drawdown, but it was a very small drawdown. Kind of makes you say, this stuff happening at the height of summer driving season, what's going on here? So I do think that lower prices are likely in the cards, but we're rapidly reaching. You know, the support is right around 44. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a bounce there. We are way overdue for the next round of fake news stories out of OPEC. So the propaganda campaign, surely it's coming. I was very surprised, actually. Normally, anytime there is a bearish inventory data coming out on a Wednesday morning in the U.S., OPEC is ready to counter it with some kind of propaganda. They've got somebody standing by in the wings, ready to talk up the price of oil. Didn't seem to happen on Wednesday, so I don't know what's going on there. Meanwhile, and I'm going to refer to a chart, folks, if you look, we have a post-game chart book, which we're going to come back to after the feature interview, but I want to talk to the first chart in that deck right now, in the post-game chart book, which our registered users received a link to in your research roundup email. That chart shows you the term structure, and what I'm convinced is going on here is that Saudi Arabia has two goals. Number one, they are trying to keep the price of oil, front month price of oil, above $50 so that they can be successful with their 2018 ambition of IPOing Saudi Aramco. The other thing that I think they're trying to do is engineer backwardation into the term structure. And the reason that they want to do that is that it keeps near-dated contracts trading at high prices. That's more money for Saudi Arabia. But at the same time, it pushes longer-dated contracts to lower prices. The result of that is that it makes it harder for the U.S. shale operators to get financing because they have to hedge their forward production 2 years ahead. So if we look at this chart, that top term structure was what happened immediately after, on May 24th, after OPEC announced this nine-month production cut extension. It did exactly what Saudi Arabia wanted it to do, which was to produce backwardation through 2018 and 2019. Backwardation, again, is the condition where each successive delivery month is priced lower than the one before it. So they created that backwardation, which is exactly what they wanted to. And the way they achieved that was by saying they were going to have this production cut that's going to help prices in the short term, but they went out of their way to say at the end of those 9 months, production would be increasing again. And that's what's pushing down the contracts that are dated further out. Look what happened, though, just about a week later. The next term structure down that you see, the middle one, is from May 31st, the end of the month, only about a week, 7 or 8 days later than that term structure that shows so much backwardation on the 24th. It's almost gone already. And then if you look at this week, the bottom term structure that you see where it's structural contango from the beginning, that is from Tuesday or Wednesday of this week, Tuesday, I believe, that I had pulled that chart up. So what is happening here is Saudi Arabia has failed in their attempt to keep the price above $50, and Saudi Arabia has failed, despite a valiant attempt, to engineer backwardation into the term structure. If I'm right that those were their two primary goals, then it is very easy to see here that one of two things happens. Either they try harder, or they give up on those strategies and they revert to simply competing for market share by trying to increase their production and sell as much oil as they can. So what I'm really watching for here, and I think is going to be a critically important signal in the market, is Saudi Arabia going to say, boy, if we want to achieve our goals, we have to do a much bigger production cut, twice as big of a production cut, and we've really got to start telling the market that we're here to do no matter what it takes, we're going to support the market, and if that means doubling the size of our production cut, we're going to do it. That's what it's going to take, Patrick, at this point, in order for OPEC to achieve their two goals. Are they going to actually be willing to do those things, to give up more market share in order to achieve these goals? Or are they going to say, hey, a lot of analysts are really skeptical about the viability of this IPO in 2018 to start with. Things are not going our way. Let's just go back and compete for market share. I kind of lean towards the latter. And definitely if they give up on their IPO plans, that's going to push them back towards just competing for market share. So Saudi Arabia's next strategy decision is going to be the important thing to watch. And we'll find out from their messaging. I think it's probably indicative. Why is it, Patrick, that we haven't heard any propaganda out of OPEC after the Wednesday inventory numbers came out? Maybe it's because they're in a powwow saying, okay, we got a big decision here. We've either got to pull out all the stops, make a really big concession and double the size of our production cut, or we've got to change strategy. That's a big decision. Let's not rush through it. Maybe they're just thinking about it. Once OPEC starts talking again, it's going to be very, very interesting to see what they have to say.
Well, you know what, Eric? I wanted to actually just move on to gold here, though, because what we saw was the gold took its cue from the dollar index, and as soon as all these currencies started to make their moves, gold immediately reversed its strength yesterday and started to sell, and is now trading around that 1254 level. What's your thinking here on gold?
Well, we saw a very strong rally into the FOMC meeting because people thought this would be somehow a dovish hike, as a lot of people had coined that term. I guess it wasn't as dovish as they thought in terms of Janet's messaging in the press conference afterwards. So after the press conference, it gave all of those profits back. I don't really have a strong view about what happens next to gold here. I do note that with other commodities selling off very, very strongly, gold is kind of holding its own here, so I'm impressed by that. But I'm still not ready to make a directional call. I'm on the sidelines.
Well, let's move on to bond yields, because what we saw was a big jump in bond prices and drop in bond yields, not on Janet Yellen, but actually on the inflation numbers and on the retail sales. And they just really consolidated it once the Fed started speaking. What's your thinking here on interest rates when we're trading right now around the 216 handle?
Yeah, we're back up here after testing 212 earlier in the week. And I think that that 212 number was a lot of flattening of the yield curve going into the FOMC. We're seeing it bounce back here. I think eventually, though, we're going to trade below the 212 and down towards 2%. I think also, though, it's probably more interesting right now to look at the 210s yield curve as opposed to the outright yield on the 10-year, because that's probably going to give you a better indication of how the market is reacting. Obviously, the twos, being two-year treasuries, are going to be much more directly impacted by policy rates at the front end of the curve, whereas the 10-year is more reflective of economic views and so forth. So looking at that spread and how it evolves in reaction to the FOMC meeting is something that I'm going to ask Keith more about in the feature interview.
You know, an interesting comment on that is the fact that while we have not seen yields go anywhere near where they were in the summer of 2016, the spreads between the twos and tens are actually approaching their summer lows. And so we're actually seeing that yield curve flattening, going full throttle, even in spite of the fact that the 10 years are nowhere near their lows that they were in the summer. And nonetheless, well, thanks for that market update, Eric. But before we move on to that featured interview, we added that donate button on the website, and you wanted to comment quickly on that. What's going on there?
You know, I was just really flattered and want to take a minute out of the show to just say thank you to the huge number of people that have made $100 donations, and in one case, a $200 donation. I wasn't expecting donations of that size to be pouring in the way that they are. It's extremely helpful in helping us to defray our production costs. And if these kind of donations continue, we'll be able to do more and produce better content and more content. So we really appreciate it. And for the people who made the $100 and $200 donations, I can't thank you enough. I feel incredibly flattered.
And this week's featured interview guest is Keith McCullough, founder and CEO of HedgEye. Registered users should definitely check out the Research Roundup email before the interview and download Keith's chart book. As well, there's a link to a one-month free trial to all of HedgEye's non-institutional products, more than $200 of value, available for all of our Macro Voices registered users. If you have not registered, you can still go to macrovoices.com and register for the free account. Once registered, you can access the free trial link from the Research Library section of macrovoices.com. Look for the instructions next to Keith's picture on our homepage. Now, Eric's interview with Keith is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is HedgEye founder and CEO Keith McCullough. Keith, thanks so much for joining us. I'm particularly keen to get your perspective on the dollar index, which is where I like to start all of these macro interviews. We've had a lot of guests on the program articulate a very intelligent, bullish, secular view on the dollar. But dude, look at the chart. It's not looking pretty. What do you think is happening next for the dollar?
Well, first, thanks for having me on. It's good to join you. The dollar is near to my heart. That's what I too start every day with. The process, you know, is largely dollar centric. So, well, I think the difference if you're looking at the dollar on a what I call an immediate term trade basis or an intermediate term trend basis, both we would call that bearish. But from a long term perspective, which is a different duration, of course, the dollar to me looks fine. But you know, why does it look weak on an immediate to an intermediate term basis? I think that's pretty straightforward. Inflation expectations, or as we affectionately call it, reflation's rollover. That's one of our big macro themes, and we had it before all of consensus started talking about it. But the reality is that, you know, when you pound inflation expectations, you get the very obvious following domino, which is the Fed's going to be less hawkish. So the way that I kind of see the dollar declining into the Fed in particular today is that the dollar is going to sell off into the news because it's going to be a dovish rate hike. So they're going to raise rates based on the prior rate of inflation. Inflation's come down quickly, and our forecast is that inflation continues to go down through at least Q1 of 2018. We think that CPI headline probably drops closer to 1.1%, which is still actually a lot lower than where even reported inflation was this morning on a year-over-year basis. I think it was at 1.9%.
We should let our listeners know, too, that we recorded this interview on Wednesday morning, so we don't yet have the FOMC result, which our listeners will have heard. But I think it's pretty clear that the dovish hike is what's in the cards. Let's come back to your reflation rolling over theme. The slide deck that you sent us, we've got several slides in that. Our registered users can find the download link in the Research Roundup email. If you're not registered yet, we told you earlier in the program how to get the slide deck. Walk us through this, what you see in the reflation trade, because what I find particularly interesting is most of the people now that are all telling the same story because it's popular about the reflation trade rolling over, they're also turning into big equity bears. And you've got the reflation trade rolling over theme, but you're actually equity bullish. So how does this all tie together?
Well, I think if you just separate, down two columns and you have your longs and your shorts, I mean, if you want to be short reflation, the other side of that ledger is being long what we call real growth. So real growth accelerates. I'm pretty sure that most people that do macro should understand this. If they don't, it's very simple calculus. When inflation slows on a rate of change basis, the deflator, i.e. how you calculate GDP, falls. So the deflator falls, then real GDP rises. I mean, it's not that complicated. And I do agree agree that a lot of people, I think a lot of people, you know, to be clear, Eric, I think people, a lot of people have been bearish on the stock market for the last 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 months, and they just kind of wander on out there like a macro tourist to the next thing that is bearish. Now, there's always going to be something that's bearish. My goal is to find it. I mean, there's a bear market always somewhere in global macro, but it doesn't always have to be where you're hoping it is, which most people start with, wow, that market is expensive. It must be a short. In macro, clearly, cheap gets cheaper and expensive gets more expensive. So I want to be uniquely long expensive because I think real growth expectations, tech and consumer discretionary, they are two favorite sectors in the market. Our least favorite currently is energy. So we're on the right side of the barbells. And I want to, and if it looks cheap on energy, great. I think it's going to get cheaper, especially if it's levered cheap with a bad balance sheet. Because again, we're bearish on oil prices, we're bearish on commodity prices, we're bearish on anything that is reflation. And I think that that's the most basic way to summarize it. And I think that if you go beyond just the U.S. centric view, which has largely to do with base effects, i.e. where reflation came from and where the deflation came before that and where the commodity inflation bubble from Ben Bernanke came before that, then I think that you look forward and globally, actually, I'm not bullish on China. I'm not bullish on European growth from here. I'm not bullish on a lot of things. You don't have to be either bullish or bearish on everything. I think that there are certain websites that you could read to get that view, but that's more of an advertising model than it is an accuracy one.
Moving on to bond yields, the twos tens curve has been flattening. Again, we are taping this before the FOMC outcome. Where do you see this going? Is this flattening just anticipation of a dovish hike at today's meeting on Wednesday? Or do you think there's more to this trend? And what does it tell you about where bond yields in general are headed from here?
Well, I mean, naturally, any kind of a compression in the yield spread, tens, twos, as you know, that's bad for banks. So that's one reason why the banks aren't the place that we like to be on the long side. Like I said, I like to be long real growth, which is tech and consumer discretionary. What you see functionally is the Fed is going to raise rates. I mean, unless they do what they usually don't do or rarely do, which is go ahead of or against Fed fund futures expectations, they're going to raise rates. So they raise rates. The short end of the curve has actually been rising. That's why you're getting a compression, because the short end of the curve is rising as the long end of the curve is falling. And the long end of the curve is falling because inflation expectations are falling. I don't expect to see like a super type of a flattening from here. I think that most of it is probably in there. Yeah, I'm looking at a range on 10s, 2s of probably 75 by 95 basis points, and I think you're right in the middle of that. So I don't think that there's a lot to do there right now. I think a lot of people are screaming bloody murder on the U.S. stock market. Stop it from going up. Stop it from going up because the yield spread is compressing. It's like, no, just short the banks. I mean, it's not that complicated. And moreover, I actually think that the better place to be short banks isn't in the U.S. right now. It's actually going back to the great short call that was shorting European banks, because that yield spread, of course, is compressing within a lower level of yields to begin with.
Let's broaden that to Europe in general. It seems like everybody's jumping for joy that all the problems in Europe are solved and everything's better. I'm not quite sure I buy that. Where do you think, in terms of exit risk contagion, so the world did not quite come falling apart in these last couple of elections in Europe, but it seems to me like, the direction is kind of clear that there's a lot of trouble ahead. Do you think that this rally in the euro is going to continue? How much farther does it have to go? And where is this all headed? And maybe tie that into your view on European banks, particularly where in Europe? Is it all of Europe? Is it southern versus northern? What's the view there?
Yeah, I think, when we started the discussion, we started with the dollar. I mean, you could easily go back and start it all over with the euro versus the dollar. That's the one that's super interesting to me. The euro versus the dollar is not only the biggest consensus net long position in all of global macro, and the biggest, there's only one, obviously, and I define that by looking at futures and options contracts, non-commercials, which basically tells you where the institutional consensus is. So you see the biggest net long position currently is in the euro, and I think there's a couple reasons for that. One, Macron won in France, and a lot of people had euro short versus dollar on coming into the year, not because of Trump, but because they had to hedge against Le Pen risk. And Le Pen risk obviously evaporated, so that net short position came unglued. And then on the U.S. side of the trade, you had obviously inflation expectations come down. So people start to mark down their Fed fund futures expectations on a September hike and going forward. So I think it's kind of been this perfect storm of everyone falling in love with Europe because the stock market had been going up. And now they're trying to translate that into it's different this time, which clearly it's not. I mean, European data on a sequential basis is already slowing. It was already slower than U.S. growth to begin with. The reason why you have such a great audience on Macro Voices is because these aren't the people that wake up in the morning and look at the cover of Barron's, which said buy Europe a month ago, and do that. Like, people aren't the, I think you call them the financial Flintstones, but I mean, it's like, that was not a buy signal for Europe. That was the beginning of the end for Europe, I think, because Europe is Europe. And the reality is that France voted to remain France. And I think that as we look forward, we actually have prospectively our European GDP growth forecasts are the lowest on Wall Street for the third and the fourth quarter of this year. So I think that what's going to happen is that the catalyst for the short side on the euro, and you have to be timing specific here because the dollar still has some downside and the euro still has a little of upside. But between 113, 114, 115, I think that you're shorting euros into an outlook, if you have my outlook, that reflation rolls over, European growth slows, and Draghi comes to the rescue with dovishness. And of course, the euro has been going up because people have been hoping that Draghi would get hawkish. So I think Draghi by the end of the year will be as dovish as any central banker that exists.
Let's move back to the bond market from there, Keith. You know, Jeff Gundlach got a lot of attention last year with this big call saying, okay, one spot 35, that's it. The bottom is in forever in 10-year treasury yields. We've had quite a few guests opposing that view. Where do you see this going in terms of the big picture? It seems like there is a lot of reason to think that our economy is long in the tooth. Maybe at some point we get a recession. Do we eventually see a new secular low, or do you agree with Jeff Gundlach? I don't think you ever agree with Jeff Gundlach, do you?
Well, we agree sometimes. I mean, we definitely haven't agreed this year. I mean, he's been fighting this stock market move to the upside on valuation. That's not how I roll. So, you know, when it comes to relative value, I think that that's the biggest difference between how Jeff articulates his process and how I do. Valuation to me just doesn't matter. I mean, if anything, like I said, expensive gets more expensive. It's a macro exposure. When growth's accelerating and it's expensive, growth gets more expensive. You could have shorted the stock market in 1996, 97, 98. By the time it was 1999, you're out of money because in 1996, 97, it was already at 20 times earnings. So, I mean, you can go all the way to 35 times earnings, for God's sakes. And I think that that's really the lesson. If you take that valuation lesson and you turn it upside down in bond yield terms. Interestingly, maybe not surprisingly, last year, Gundlach and I had the exact same view that bond yields would surprise to the downside at the beginning of the year, you know, and we'd been making this call for the five quarters before that. And I'm not trying to pump my own tires. It's just the call that we made, which is U.S. growth's going to slow. The Fed's going to have to pivot back to dovish, which they did multiple times, in particular in March and May. And that's really what drove. And then you finally had kind of that pile driver move in June in bond yields to the lows that you identified, largely because it was the worst U.S. jobs report since the crisis. And, you know, that had Obama's name on it, obviously. Not a lot of political pundits talk about that if they're partisan. But, you know, so you had like this, you know, this super low level of growth. In Q2 of 2016, the year-over-year growth rate bottomed in GDP terms. It was at 1.3%. So if I showed you just the sine curve of GDP growth, it came down from 3.3% in Q1 of 2015 to 1.3% in Q2 of 2016. Now, everyone who does macro should know where GDP is on the sine curve. You know, you draw a sine curve, the cycle is a sine curve, and it went down 200 basis points across five quarters, and bond yields went straight down, and the best exposure you could have had was being long long-term bonds. And that's why you have a lot of people that are forever long-term bonds, because it was such a fantastic position with no volatility. And, you know, from here, you know, as growth's accelerating, I don't think you're going back to the all-time low, certainly not now. But once we start to see a slowdown again, Eric, that's when I'll start to be talking about lower bond yields. And it's not, you know, it's not Jeff Gundlach or God that can tell you what the level is. The way I do it is I wake up 2 feet on the floor, again, God willing, every morning, and I measure and map, you know, volatility, price, volume of the market. And if we start getting to a place where in my intermediate-term signal to long-term signal, I can see a lower low, I'll make that call. Currently, I'm not seeing anything remotely close to a lower low. I can't even get below 205 on the 10-year. So that's the call we have. That's the call we're sticking with. I don't think that the bond market has any really super interesting things to do right now. We're long municipal bonds, for example, because we thought rates would come down into the Fed making a dovish hike. I think the more exciting stuff is clearly to be long the NASDAQ, and that's where I've been very vocal and not uncomfortably so. I kind of have fun with it. I've never done this before with the NASDAQ.
Since you brought that up again, let's go back to your long view on tech stocks. You know, I was fascinated that so many people outright panicked on Friday. Oh my God, we had a crash, an outright crash where everything went down by 2.5%? And it's amazing to me that that's a crash. Now, oil, you know, down from $100 a couple of years ago, that's, everybody's used to that one now. It's not newsworthy anymore. So do you worry at all? I mean, some people would say that what happened on Friday was maybe the first sign of weakness, the first, what's the analogy, the finger in the dike or something, and it's all about to fall apart from here, and another NASDAQ crash like we had in 2000 is just around the corner, just you wait. How would you respond to that kind of viewpoint?
Well, I think, again, the manic media, the mainstream media, like a lot of people in this country are very well aware that the mainstream media, you know, in general popular media, like whatever it be, NBC versus Fox, et cetera. And I think a lot of people kind of get that they're being lied to, and or maybe not lied to outright, but they're just being painted a partisan, you know, version of the story. If you go to our world, financial media has not only more mediocre minds, but far less accurate and competent, I guess, reporting of what is actually going on in the macro market. At least in popular media, where you're talking about some, you know, popular things that are undebatable, like maybe even the weather, they probably still even have a partisan view of that. But when it comes to our world, it is laughable. You know, what people describe as these market risks and these market moves. I mean, that morning, to your point, the mainstream media, whether it be Bloomberg or CNBC or whatever, you know, like you called Freddie Flintstone, I mean, they're talking about a rout. I mean, a rout is what was happening in Pakistan, Russia, and to your point, in oil. I mean, the oil is down 19%. I mean, that's a rout. And of course, when you get those, you get tremendous buying opportunities. So, you know, I'm a huge fan of sandpile theory, complexity theory, chaos theory, however you want to define it. There's always grains of sand that will knock that sand pile down. You know, when everybody and their brother on these, on kind of mainstream financial, or as I call it, old wall media TV, is telling you that that's it, it's probably not it. That's the point. What I'm really looking for is data to support that the thing that drove what is becoming just a parabolic move and a fantastic return for being long real growth, i.e. tech stocks, and big cap and size and balance sheets. These are all style factors that are working, of course. You have to tell me how growth is going to stop accelerating for me to get out of that way. If you can't show me that, and we run a predictive tracking algorithm with 30 data points per month, 90 data points per quarter, I think it's as accurate as anything that you can find buy side or sell side. And again, I want that to come across the wrong way. I've worked on it for 19 years. We have a lot of pride in that process. Yeah, I'm going to buy every dip, and we have, and thank God I have, because that's what's really made for the year. So yeah, they're big names. Yeah, they're, you know, for valuation experts, they're overvalued. But history has told us that overvalued gets more overvalued until you can tell me how growth slows. In 2000, coming out of the 1999 bubble, it was a clean-cut deceleration in the economy in the first half of 2000. We currently have a clean-cut acceleration in the economy in the first part of 2017 that we'll see. Actually, the fastest growth rate that we're going to see, we think, will be in Q3. So that's what I think the best economist in the market has right, and I'm aligned with him, and his name is Mr. Market.
Since you're a tech-friendly kind of guy, let's touch on Bitcoin and Ethereum and all these cryptocurrencies. You know, I've been very skeptical. I think it's cool technology. I'm a technology guy at heart. But, you know, these are designed to undermine the ability of governments to do what governments want to do, which is control everything. So I'm really skeptical that they'll be allowed to really take hold in any meaningful way. What's your view? We saw this Putin meeting with the Ethereum guy last week. You know, where is this headed, if anywhere? Is there any real news here?
Well, Bitcoin's a fun story, just like the tulip bulb story was a fun story. And tulips, you know, God knows there's still tulips outside the window I'm looking at right now. You know, it's not to say that technology or new ideas that become bubbly in price isn't fascinating and exciting. And I agree with you. I'm not against technology. But Bitcoin as a currency, I got two very big problems with this as a macro manager of big risk. You know, one, liquidity and a two-way market, and two, transparency of the market. I mean, I have no transparency on who runs this thing. At least with the central bankers in the rigged system that we have, I can see them. They have to speak to me. They have to give me their model. They have to give me their reasoning. You know, so those are the big problems that I have. I mean, I remember going to a Bitcoin conference, quote unquote, a fintech conference, because don't forget that the other side of this too, and I'm sure this is going to offend people who love Bitcoin, but it won't offend the people who sold Bitcoin before it crashed last time. I went to a fintech conference and I just raised my hand in a couple of meetings. I said, so how do I short this? And obviously I wasn't, you know, invited back to the conference, but the reality is that to have a real currency, like if you believe that Bitcoin is the second coming of God when it comes to currencies, then you got to be able to short the thing. I mean, there's you got to give some transparency on a two-way market. So for me, that's kind of how I look at it. I actually don't spend a lot of time. I think I probably just spent the most amount of time I've spent thinking about Bitcoin all year long in that breath. But that's how I think about it.
Let's move on to emerging markets in general. You seem to have a view that the weakness in the U.S. dollar is probably transitory with everything going on in Europe, and that eventually the dollar rally will resume in earnest. If that happens, is EM going to get crushed the way a lot of people have predicted?
Well, I mean, EM generally we've not had a call on this year, and I try to focus my eggs into the basket that I'm making a call on. So our two big calls have been U.S. real growth accelerating and reflation's rollover. There's plenty of ways you can play that in global macro. If you want to play it that way, then why, you know, spin your wheels in EM? I realize EM's had a good move, but also realize that EM's had a good move that's highly correlated to the inverse of EM, which is U.S. dollars. And, you know, again, I still can't see until the Fed, really, for me, it's a timing and catalyst thing. We actually have a GDP number by the second and third quarter of this year going to 2.5% to 2.8%. The question is going to be, will the Fed get hawkish on real growth accelerating? Historically, they wait because they're real, you know, they're kind of like, you know, sitting there watching inflation falling and getting nervous, because the biggest fear of the Fed, of course, is deflation. So the dollar to me and the euro, I mean, these things are just kind of going to hover and trade sideways. I don't think that there's some big bang risk. I could obviously be wrong on that. That's why you know, on the macro show every morning or in the early look note that I write, I reserve the unalienable right until some central planner takes it away to change my mind. But for now, we just don't really have a high conviction call, if you will, on the emerging markets.
Let's touch on precious metals next. I know that you sent your subscribers a buy call on gold, I think, on Tuesday afternoon. As we're speaking on Wednesday, you're definitely in the money on that trade. So congratulations on getting that call right. But tell us a little bit more about the rationale behind it. Why do you see precious metals? Is it a short-term call just based on today's FOMC meeting, or is there more to the picture than that?
No, this is it's definitely a short-term catalyst call. Not all my calls are like that. In fact, few of them are. Most of our calls are intermediate term trend calls, effectively, with immediate term catalysts. So this is a call that the Fed would make a dovish rate hike, but also that real in between now and when Q3 GDP gets reported, which is sometime in Q4, you really kind of have this vacuum of nothingness where the Fed is getting nervous and talking about it. And on an ongoing basis, you're seeing further and further declines in reported things like consumer price inflation. So I think provided that interest rates, and this is really the way that I risk manage gold from a short term to an intermediate term perspective, I just go with my real rate view. So wherever I think real interest rates are going, that's where I'm going to go with gold. So in other words, if I see real interest rates falling, I'm going to buy gold. If I see real interest rates rising, I'm going to book gains in gold and get out and maybe even short it. And some people get upset when I short it. Some people get upset when you short anything. But the reality is that I go both ways and I kind of like it. So that's the point. You get real rates right, you're going to get gold right. And I do think globally, actually, it's the biggest threat to bond yields globally is the demographic kind of sort of Damocles that is hanging over, in particular, Europe, the south of Europe and Japan's head when it comes to the aging of the population. They, unlike us, they do not have a millennial population, which is accelerating in terms of its rate of change of growth. And I do think that that's going to equate to lower and lower bond yields again and again and again in Japan and in Germany and in Switzerland. And I think that that's really, you know, that's, if you're buying gold in those currencies, I think that that's an even better idea because the demographic case there is different than what it is here, which is, by the way, another thing I disagree with Gundlach on. I don't think that he's doing the math right if he's saying that demographics here in the U.S. are the same problem that I've identified them being for the last decade. And I've been on the same side of him as this. In the U.S., what you actually have is the 35 to 54-year-old age bucket, which is the biggest spending bucket in the U.S. generation. That's actually bottomed and accelerates for the next 3 to 5 years. So that's the differentiation between U.S. growth, or at least partly between U.S. real growth and, say, Southern European growth, where the 35 to 54-year-old population is basically falling off the face of the earth in rate of change terms.
Kyle Bass and a number of other notable people have asserted a view that essentially says that the credit expansion that's occurred in China since 2009 is a ticking time bomb. And eventually what's going to happen is it's going to cripple the banking system. They're going to have to recap their banks. That's going to force the PBOC, whether they want to or not, to dramatically devalue the yuan, possibly overnight. That's going to send a wave of deflation around the world. And, you know, the world's coming to an end as a result of all this. What do you think about that view?
Well, I don't think the world's going to come to an end. We're bearish on China, but for very different reasons. I mean, we're bearish on Chinese growth just decelerating. And Chinese growth, as you know, last year in rate of change terms accelerated fabulously because they had one of the bigger stimuli that they've ever had. You know, now that obviously was a big problem for the end of the world China view. The difference between China on that view and the view that I have is, you know, China is not like a— you can't really think of China like a— like you might think of the Thai baht crisis, or you think of any other emerging market, because China has what we call a closed capital account. So you don't really have all that foreign money that can come in and come out as fast as it does. This, you know, this is a dramatically different— and the extension of that, which is runs on banks. So we don't think that there's going to be a run on Chinese deposits. We don't think that there's a huge international flow position to be concerned of that is going to all of a sudden wake me up one morning as opposed to some Trump tweet and, you know, change my life. But, you know, the beauty of macro is that I could be completely wrong on that. The beauty of macro also is that people can come up with grandiose theories that sound like Big Bang theories and lose a lot of money for a long period of time where we make money on the other side. So, you know, that's why it's such a beautiful game to play. There's Big Bang theories, and then there's reality, and then there's just risk managing the macro market every single day. If I do come up with any kind of an— I generally don't come up with theories, Eric. It comes up with the measuring and mapping of data, economic data and market data. If those two things, or one of those two things, starts to say to me that the end of the world is nigh, then I'm probably going to pack up and find some other part of the world to go to.
All righty. Well, that's a very succinct view, to say the least. I want to shift gears here now, Keith, because, and I want to share with our listeners how this particular interview came about. I was talking on the phone with a prospective investor in my fund who asked me, he said, Eric, you know, I love your Macro Voices podcast, but I'm having a lot of trouble finding a lot of similar quality content elsewhere on the web. What else should I be listening to or paying attention to? And I said, you know, there's thousands, if or hundreds anyway, of great podcast for the retail audience. But as far as professional level, serious investors, I really only know of three, which is Macro Voices, Real Vision, and HedgEye. And he immediately said, well, what's HedgEye? You talk about Real Vision on Macro Voices all the time. You've never mentioned HedgEye. I've listened to every episode. What are you talking about? So I told him what HedgEye is, and he said, great. And after I got off the phone with him, I thought, boy, he's right. We've never talked about HedgEye on Macro Voices. So we normally leave the give you a chance to promote your stuff till the end of the interview. I'm going to make an exception here because I honestly believe that it is newsworthy for our audience who have been asking. If you want to get something that's as high quality as Macro Voices, if you want more of it, really, HedgEye and Real Vision are the only things that I know about that fit the bill. Our listeners already know all about Real Vision because we've given them a lot of free promotion. So please tell us in your own words, what is HedgEye? Who is it for? What is it about?
Well, thanks for that. I mean, that's humbling, suffice to say, that because I would have never, you know, dreamt that maybe 9 or 10 years ago when I came up with the idea that is HedgEye. HedgEye, you know, started with me getting fired, Eric. So I was a hedge fund manager at Carlyle, and at the end of the day, our credit guys blew up the fund. So in the end, everybody got fired. But I was really on a non-compete. I couldn't go back to run a hedge fund anytime soon. And I thought to myself, why not create a real research product that doesn't have any banking, any conflicts of interest, assets under management, advertising, broker dealer, nothing. You know, I'd been a consumer of institutional research my whole career. And, you know, as I'm sure you and many would acknowledge, you know, the quality and the deterioration of the quality of the sell side research, you know, it's terrible. So I decided to start something, you know, that would compete with that research. So we started selling what buy-siders would care on, which are long and short ideas. And that's why we called it HedgEye. I wanted to create some transparency around the word hedge. So that's hence the I part. And I wanted to make sure that people didn't think that the word hedge was a bad thing. So, you know, over the years, I really worked hard at, you know, making this a transparent, accountable, and trustworthy brand and platform where people can look at it, see that we're real people. We're not trying to, like, you know, impose some kind of a manipulative view on markets with assets under management, pushing our book or anything like that, or trying to sell you a banking deal or a broker dealer kind of a commission. And that's really been the genesis of the property. So I think the one thing that looks like a little bit like what you do and what Real Vision does is we have a thing called Real Conversations. So Real Conversations, you can look at the whole archive and any new one. We basically do it for free. You know, I told my mom a long time ago, I said, look, you know, I said, the goal here is to change the world a little bit, not to just run a hedge fund and make money. Not that people that run hedge funds don't change the world. You know, you can do it however you want to do it, but I wanted to do it out in the open. And that's what HedgeEye really is. You can see me every day on Twitter at 4 or whatever in the morning, some godforsaken hour. And I apologize for that, but you'll see me there. You can see me with the Real Conversations, which we have a podcast product for, which is free. And then, of course, we have, like, you know, subscription products, which are for both institutions and individuals. Institutional business is like 95% of our business. So that's another thing. We've already validated our work and research with the best investors in the world who effectively that I'd say circled trillions of dollars under management at this point. So our views have already been vetted, if you will, by the world's best investors. And by the time, you know, we create a product for the, call it the retail investor, the high net worth investor, we feel that if they know what they're doing, they're going to know what they get, which is a lot of value for not a lot.
I wanted to let you put it in your own words to start with, but I'm just going to add my words, which is, you know, the way I think of what you do is you provide a research department to people that can't afford to have a research department, whether that be a high net worth individual investor who's serious about their investing, a guy like myself who runs a small hedge fund. You know, I have fantasies in my head about how I walk into the office and there's like this team of 80 or so ass-kissing underlings that have all analyzed the market and they hand me as I walk in, you know, what the day's trading range are. You do that. Well, actually, you don't do that, really. You totally knock it out of the park with sending me the day's trading range, Keith. As far as you delivering on the ass-kissing underling part of it, I don't think I feel that energy from you. But so the important part of it, though, you provide that, and you also, I think, are set up. I think of Macro Voices and Real Vision as what professionals and serious investors listen to at night at the gym, on the treadmill. You're really what people tune into in the morning in order to find out what's going on in the market today. You got your team has been up getting things ready. And unlike Macro Voices or Real Vision that are producing content that's more timeless, you're really doing a show every morning, which is about today's market, what's happening right now for people who are tied into the market.
And that's, you know, that, unlike our Real Conversations podcast, which are free, that's called the Macro Show. And that's a subscription product. So it's like $40 a month. And what we do it at 9 o'clock every day from 9 to 9:30. We take, your questions. Actually, the questions come from guys like you. They come from big institutional managers, small ones, big ones, tall ones, you know, and they come from individuals. It's amazing. Like actually, this is kind of an interesting statistic. The average annual income of our subscribers is over 400,000. So we have, like, you know, we have people who have made money that don't want to lose their money, and we have people who want to learn. And that's what we're doing every morning. You can save yourself the entire day of watching these nonsensical channels by just simply, we think, watching for 30 minutes to tell you what's actually going on in the world without a political bias. Like, I'm not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat, I am a Canadian with a green card. So we don't start every day with whether Trump's going to be impeached, impaled, or imprisoned. I mean, that's not what we talk about. We talk about the risk range of the market, what the catalysts are fundamentally, what the current data is. So it really gets you, you know, in 30 minutes, and you can watch it on replay too, obviously, anytime you want. But that's if you're going to get ready to risk manage or engage in the market every day, you know, that's why I created that. It's kind of like the morning meeting. You know what I mean? The morning meeting at any good fund, if you have a research team, you go through what the plan is and what the catalysts are, what the risks are, et cetera. So I just kind of opened that up and made it transparent.
I think it's a fantastic product. I had hoped what you do in that morning show, the Macro Show, is you always have the top three ideas of the day that you talk through. And I know we've got those three ideas from Wednesday's Macro Show in the slide deck that you sent us. Unfortunately, I know you've got a hard time stop here that we're coming up against, so we're not going to be able to dive into that. I'll tell you what, though, since we didn't have time for that, any chance we can get our listeners maybe a week-long free trial? I know you have a flagship product, which is basically everything that you do for non-institutional customers. Can we hook our Macro Voices listeners up with that?
Yeah, for sure. Actually, we'll give you a whole free month, man. That's thanks for having me on the show. That's definitely something we would be very happy to do.
That's fantastic. I know that is a one thing we do have to disclose is that HedgeEye is not free. Macro Voices is free. You get what you pay for, folks. And if you want Macro Voices quality content every single morning produced in live video, obviously it costs money. But Keith is just, I was glad to get a week. We've got a month. So we'll get a link to that. We're holding you to that one, dude. We'll get a link to that offer into the Research Roundup email. And unfortunately, as much as I would love to pick your brain on all of the hot topics you've had this week. You've been talking about crude oil. You've been talking about the 10-year. You've been talking about all-time highs in stock markets and what it means. Everybody can get that by taking advantage of the free trial. So we'll do that. We'll have to close it there. I cannot thank you enough for your time today. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Keith. You know, he truly is bullish on this market, which, you know, it's always interesting to bring a guest that looks a little bit at the market a little bit differently than we do. You know, and certainly his views that the NASDAQ is a place to continue to look for the further gains is really insightful. This idea that the market can just, you know, go from expensive to even more expensive and just keep going. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, I agree completely with what you just said, and I think that Keith has a very sound handle on this. He's not in this camp of people that think that stocks are cheap here, which I think is nuts. He's very quick to say he doesn't focus on valuations because this kind of market tends to move with momentum, and things that are expensive can get more expensive. And so I definitely, you know, my style of trading, I wouldn't go outright long the NASDAQ here, as he's inclined to do. I'd look at calls maybe, but I think he makes a very excellent argument. I want to say too, Patrick, that I was really surprised and delighted by Keith's generosity in offering all of our registered users a free one-month trial to their HedgeEye Risk Manager product, which is basically all of their different products that are for non-institutional customers combined into one package. I think that costs $250 a month or $220 a month or something. It's not cheap, and he's given basically the carte blanche to all of our listeners. So I definitely encourage everyone to take advantage of that. Keith has a very strong personality, a very outspoken style. People tend to love his style or hate it. You know, he's definitely not Mr. Humble on the air. He has very strong views, and he's not at all hesitant to express them. But I think that one thing's for sure, if you get something for free, it's worth giving it a try. So I do encourage everyone to take advantage of that free trial. Check out the morning show, which is kind of Keith's lessons on macro, every morning at 9 o'clock. And you'll also get, they send email alerts with their various trade recommendations and a number of other things that they do. And I hope that everybody enjoys that. But Patrick, I want to come back now to the way you and I see the markets, which is a little bit different than the way I think Keith sees it. I would not go long the NASDAQ here. I think to myself back to 1999 when I wanted to short tech stocks. Well, thank heaven I didn't short tech stocks because they still had 50% to go to the upside. But on the other hand, you know, how do you get that timing right? I'd much rather do that through options as opposed to outright. So as we look at the NASDAQ, we talked a little bit last week about the vol skew that exists in the S&P where the calls are cheaper than the puts. Is that true on the NASDAQ as well?
Well, you know, thanks, Eric. Well, what we did was we shared on page 2 of the chart book that we accompanied for the post game. And what I have here on page 2 is the NASDAQ volatility skew for the September expiration. And when someone's looking at this, you can see that the volatility gets very expensive when you're going to the lower strikes on the NASDAQ. But what's interesting is the at-the-money implied volatility is hovering around that 15-16%. But literally every percent that you're going higher on the NASDAQ, up to 10% out of the money, the implied volatility keeps getting lower and lower, and it gets cheaper and cheaper, at least from a volatility premium perspective, to actually buy call options. And, you know, I wanted to take the opportunity to kind of us to explore the idea of why this exists. What kind of a skew is there? Usually the at-the-money options tend to have some of the lowest implieds. And yet here we have on both the NASDAQ and the S&P these big, you know, on these charts, these big drops of implied volatility as you're going out of the money. And what I found was interesting was when I was reading an article from JP Morgan's Marco Kolonovic, he addressed this idea with at least his view as to what he thought was going on. And I thought it was an interesting kind of perspective on why this kind of askew exists. And he was saying that he estimates that the supply from yield-seeking risk premium strategies grew by 1 billion vega, or 30% of the S&P 500 options market. In addition to these, large inflows of passive funds put further pressure on volatility. And so basically what I'm taking from that comment that he made there is that we're seeing an incredibly large amount of yield-seeking option premium selling, and the natural thing for almost all portfolio managers that are overlaying this as a strategy on a core index holding is they sell the vast majority of their options out of the money. And when we have this big mass of open interest sitting there in these out of the money options, if everyone's on the sell side, the volatility just has to get cheaper. And this is really interesting because that means that for us to express a view, let's say we take Keith's view that the market is still going to go higher. Well, you know, how do you get this asymmetry, this convexity in a trade where, you know, obviously the market is expensive and at some point if the rug gets pulled out from underneath it, you know, there could be big losses. So how do you trade the upside in a risk managed way? And I find it really amazing to see that these out of the money options just get cheaper and cheaper.
Well, that's very interesting to me, Patrick, because the way you describe this, you're saying that a lot of people are right now because of a view they hold right now, there is so much fear that the world is coming to an end that all these people are selling these essentially covered calls, and that's depressing the price and creating this bizarre volatility skew. Well, if I think about being on the other side of that trade, if I'm buying the call out of the money, the usual downside to buying a call out of the money is you're fighting time decay, theta, the whole time. You're waiting for that option to move into the money, and it's losing value to time decay. It seems to me that if there's a mean reversion in the underlying implied volatility, that's going to basically produce a profit that will defray the theta decay and the value of that option. So it makes the long-dated option even more attractive, if I've understood you correctly. Did I get that right?
Oh, absolutely. Now, I want to say one caveat is that even though the call option may, in fact, be on a relative basis cheaper, you still actually have to be right about the direction of the market. There's no denying that if the market doesn't go up, that these call options would expire with no value. But for its actual base volatility, these options are relatively cheap, and it's an easy way to express the trade, and especially when we're here pretty much close to all-time new highs on the markets, where there at some point there could be a market correction, easily a 10% market correction to the downside, you're getting the asymmetry in the trade where you can continue to participate and know what your worst case scenario is. But what on page 3, what's interesting, I wanted to just kind of add to this point, I showing the open interest on the QQQs. Now, in the earlier one, I was showing the index options on the NDX, on the NASDAQ. But here, the QQQs have a much larger amount of open interest in the options market, very liquid and very well traded option chain. And what you can see here is where the belly of the open interest is. And what I found particularly fascinating is the fact that there's like this big bulk of about 370,000 option contracts sold at the 145 strike on the QQQs, which are trading around 138 at the time. And so these out of the money, going about 5% out of the money, there's this this massive open interest strike. And I would speculate based on what, you know, Marco Kolonovic is suggesting there, that I wouldn't be surprised if a vast majority of the open interest was on the sell side by people covered call writing on this.
Well, Patrick, I love the way you describe that trade, because the idea that the Vega upside offsetting the theta expense of that longer term out of the money option, I think that's a very appealing way to play Keith's view that there could be a lot more upside. But all this talk about volatility has gotten me thinking about a tweet that I saw this week. One of the guys on Twitter actually went out to dinner in a restaurant, and get this, the waitress was short the VIX through the ETF. Now, when we talked to Raul Paul a year ago about how the short the VIX trade was overcrowded and the risk of an unwind if everybody's on one side of the boat was vicious, it was vicious back then. We're at the point now where the waitress in the restaurant is short the VIX. So what do you think about that situation? And you know, what opportunity does it create for us in the market?
Now, what's interesting is when I was listening to Jeffrey Gundlach's webcast on Tuesday, he made a comment on the VIX. And what it basically said, it was that it was a trade that has made a lot of money and it's very, very crowded, which suggests to him that the days of low volatility are numbered. But more importantly, he made a bold call to suggest that he probably won't see it continue through year end. And so here we have Jeffrey come out and essentially already call out these short volatility traders. And it's interesting is that in that same webcast, he basically also suggested that he does anticipate a summer market correction, even though he doesn't believe that it will lead to a recession and that this is like a big bear market, but we're overdue for a market correction. And I kind of, when I was listening to it, I was asking the question, well, what happens if we just have a market correction? Like, you know, a 10% market correction is completely not out of line. After we've been rallying for 6 to 8 months on the upside, for some event like that to occur. But what would happen if to the volatility trade during that period? And I go back to Marko Kolinovic, which we talked about in the earlier segment on the Qs. He made a comment in that same article saying that low volatility is not a new normal and fundamentally justified. In other words, this is not a new normal. It's just a result of macro decorrelation and massive supply of volatility through yield generation products and strategies. And he went on to make the point, given the low starting point of the VIX, these strategies are at risk of catastrophic loss. And he suggested that even if the VIX was to go from 10 up to 20, not far from its historical averages, you know, and he's saying that while that kind of increase has never happened, you know, even a scenario where, let's say, the VIX increases from like 10 to 15, and it's followed by a collapse in the liquidity, because a lot of these shorts need to have liquidity to be able to unwind, it could actually create this catastrophic loss event for many of these vol traders.
Well, and look, Patrick, at what we saw last Friday in reaction to this hiccup in the NASDAQ. People were talking about how it had crashed. You know, 2.5% is not a crash. If that's the mindset, if people have become so complacent that they think of 2.5% as a crash, what happens when there's a 5% move in one day? And when does the panic start? And as you say, with everybody on one side of the boat, everybody who could possibly be short the VIX is short the VIX. If they have to unwind all at the same time and everybody is on one side of the boat and vol comes back into the market as it does in a market correction, you could see a really ugly situation. The problem I have with this, though, Patrick, is because of the very steep contango in the VIX term structure, if you want to make the other side of that bet, if you want to make the long side, you want to buy calls on the VIX, say, you've got to get the timing right. You can't just think it's going to happen sometime in the next year. You've got to get the timing right, as far as I can see, because if you don't, you're going to just get eaten alive by the time decay because of that steep contango and each successive VIX contract being priced so much higher than the previous one.
No, Eric, you're absolutely right. You know, and there's an interesting way that I approach this idea of how to do the trades without having to deal with all of the term structure of the VIX futures, and that's using VIX options. Now, if our listeners turn to page 4 of that chart book that we put together, it's showing the VIX vol skew on the September expiration. And what's really interesting is the farther you go out of the money on the VIX, the volatility is actually skyrocketing higher, going from like a of 42% implied volatility to well over 100% farther out on the curve. And what this is basically doing is that you want to think of the VIX skew to be the reciprocal of, let's say, the NASDAQ skew, because VIX tends to spike when the NASDAQ or the S&P 500 are declining. And so while there's that fat tail on the S&P and NASDAQ on the left-hand side, it's going to be on the right-hand side of the VIX. And this makes it interesting because that means the farther you're getting out of the money, the options are getting more and more expensive. And what that does, in my opinion, is that it sets up a one particular option trade very well. And that's the idea of a debit spread. And so what on page 5 of the chart book, I put out there the VIX index options chain for that September series. So just to kind of work with this gun latch narrative, which is this idea that this summer there's going to be a correction. Now, we don't know. I don't know if he really knows or what, but we can only kind of build a trade based upon this narrative. And so what I'm showing here is that let's say you go and buy a VIX for a September $14 call option. It's a relatively expensive the $2.15 was the last price when I took the snapshot. It's bidding 210, 2.25. But if we go 6 VIX points higher up to the 20 strike, you are still getting a dollar or even a $1.05 premium for actually selling the 20. And so you can create a debit spread where you go and buy the 14 and sell the 20 for a $6 spread. And you can literally open it for just over a dollar cost, about $1.10 cost. So you actually create this beautiful asymmetry in the trade where you have literally almost 5 times the upside potential to the risk that you are outlaying. And you have till September to find out whether or not the VIX makes the jump.
I love the way you think about options, Patrick. I learned something from every one of these, because what I was concerned about is obviously if you just go one side of this with the buying the call, you're getting eaten alive. But as you say, if you're seeing an increase in volatility as you go out of the money, it's a perfect setup for that debit spread. So I hope that that explanation was clear to everyone. Certainly from some of our past interviews, we've talked more about debit spreads. So if anyone's not familiar with the concept, go back to our postgames in earlier shows. I want to move on now, though, because another interesting point I mentioned briefly with Keith was cryptocurrencies. And what I've always said is I don't believe in this stuff, because what they're designed to do is effectively to eliminate the ability of government to have too much control over our money system. And while that sounds good to me, government's not going to like it. And I've predicted that government would prevent these cryptocurrencies from going anywhere. The Ethereum guy, I can't remember his name at the moment, met with Putin this week or last week, talking about the possibility of Russia being behind the adoption of a national cryptocurrency. That caught me by surprise. So it kind of puts this cryptocurrency thing a little bit more back on my radar screen. What are your thoughts, Patrick?
Well, you know what? The one thing that I personally have to agree with is when you hear individuals like Raoul Paul talking about this being a bubble, I have to agree with him. You know, we look, I shared on page 6 of that chart book just the parabolic rises in both Ethereum and Bitcoin. And obviously, you know, the headline is, you know, that these cryptocurrencies are up thousands of percent in just this year. And it's really had a lot of bullishness associated, and it's really now almost consensus amongst the real hardcore bulls in this that this is just going to keep going, and it's got so much more upside. And, you know, it reminds me of two rules whenever you have this exponential rise like this. Bill Farrell had the 10 market rules. And the very first two rules of his 10 market rules is that markets tend to return to their average price over time, and excesses in one direction will lead to an opposite excess in the other direction. You know, and those are just rules of the way price behaves. And whenever you have this exponential hockey stick curve at the tail end of these rises, they tend to correct violently the other way. And I can't think of a better way of describing what will likely happen with cryptocurrency. This is just, again, my opinion, than to look at Amazon back in 1999. If you think back to the tech bubble, everyone was convinced that all of these tech companies like Amazon were the future. And they were right. And it worked. But it didn't change the fact that Amazon from the year 2000 to 2003 wiped out 90% of its value during the tech wreck. And, you know, now we look 15 years later, it's you know, trading at $1,000 a share. And anyone who held over the last, you know, 20 years made piles of money. But it didn't change the fact that those people that held it from 99 to 2003 got wiped out. And I can't help but to think that that's probably the potential of what could happen with cryptocurrencies, which is, yeah, they do have a very bright future for the next, you know, 15, 20 years, or even much longer. But it doesn't change the fact that this is going to be kind of ugly when it finally, the parabolic rise reverts to the mean. And what's interesting is when you look at those charts, you know, Ethereum there was at 400 just 3 days ago. It's already hit an intraday low near 250. I mean, we literally saw a 25% drop in its price from its peak price in just like 3 days. You know, these are the types of price action and volatility that is typical near these kind of parabolic top rises.
I couldn't agree more. So definitely the speculation in these currencies themselves is risky business. Unfortunately, in the interest of time, we do need to leave it there. I know some of our listeners would probably like more of this. Please keep in mind, Patrick is in the business of teaching people how to trade. That's what he does at bigpicturetrading.com. There's courses about options, courses about macro, and courses about lots of other stuff. So be sure to check out bigpicturetrading.com if you'd like to learn more about that. Meanwhile, I do so much appreciate the donations that we've received. Please keep those coming. But most importantly, we need you to register your free account at macrovoices.com. The more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best guests to come on the program. And we've really been getting some fantastic ones lately. The benefit to you of registering is that you'll receive our research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It is nothing but a compendium of links, both to supporting information, such as the chart book for today's interview with Keith McCullough, the link to the discount that's worth a couple $100 at least on the HedgEye service, as well as whatever other free cool stuff we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, what's in this week's research roundup?
Well, in this week's research roundup, our listeners will find the transcript for today's interview with Keith. There's also a link to the chart book from HedgEye, as well as the chart book that Eric and I discussed during this post-game session. There's also a link to an article highlighting some of Jeffrey Gundlach's comments during Tuesday's Double Line webcast, and also a link from our friends at Variant Perception discussing the continued deterioration of C&I lending. You can find all this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share their content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.